Hi, I'm Gareth, and this is Somewhere on Earth. People, you're in excellent company today. We bring you a producer and an expert. So I said, let's do the producer first, the most important person in the room. No disrespect to Alp, who's also waiting to come on and say hello. But Anya Diktorovic, responsible for pulling all this together. And here you are on the mic, keeping me company
indeed.
In here.
I am indeed. There are quite a few listener questions and comments. So I thought I'd just come in, get it all sorted, get all that admin out of the way, and we can move on and ready and waiting for the next lot.
There you go. Anya's comments on your comments, dear listener, because I could try opining and making comments or official, in inverted commas, statements on behalf of Somewhere on Earth and probably get them wrong. So, yeah, if Anya says it, it's true. I've learned that over a long career of working with Anya. Now, I mentioned Alp. This is Alp Toker, who is with an organisation called NetBlocks. And Alp, we'll find out a bit more about NetBlocks as we go along, but I'm just interested to know where you are in the world geographically. Let's geolocate this for you.
Right, yeah, no, absolutely. NetBlocks is London-based. I'm out and about travelling at the moment, visiting family in Istanbul, actually.
Oh.
And, you know, it's all pretty mobile, but we've been tracking internet connectivity around the world, and there's a lot going on that I'll share with you along the way.
A huge amount. There we are. So we're going to hear both from Alp and Anya as we go along. So, coming up today, there's been distress for the loved ones of Palestinians and others trapped in Gaza as internet and mobile networks are silenced. So we're discussing internet shutdowns today with Alp. And also, we're letting you set the agenda. Yes, you, dear listener, as you just heard from Anya, we are getting some of your comments and thoughts into the programme because you've been opining about everything from 3D printed houses to breast examination robots. So Anya and Alp are both here to give their reaction. That's right here, not just on the, but on your Somewhere on Earth podcast. Alrighty, so let's start by talking to Alp. And Alp, I'm going to just give you a bit of a statement that we had from somebody I know who's in the West Bank, actually, but speaking very much on behalf of people that she knows and loved ones in Gaza. And the statement goes like this: most of us have no electricity and no internet. Cellular networks are also cut off. This increases the difficulty for paramedics to receive casualty cases. So at the top there, Alp, you told us that you're with NetBlocks, your internet shutdowns observatory. And so I assume the situation in Gaza has been very high on your watch list over the last month or so. And I can imagine those words there from a Palestinian contact that we have here, those words you've just heard will be quite resonant as well, Alp.
Well, yes, we've been tracking internet connectivity in Gaza and beyond since the beginning of the conflict and earlier. And it's really distressing to see connectivity impacted as it has been. We've seen overall connectivity collapse from the 7th of October, obviously, when all this really kicked off, to some 40% of ordinary levels. But that's at the best of time. If you actually look at some of the recent disruptions, you're seeing now that there are also total or near total blackouts of connectivity. These are extended periods when really no information can enter or leave that area. So there are really serious disruptions to connectivity that potentially mean that important news, important information isn't able to leave the Gaza Strip. And also people aren't able to remain informed of what's going on. So it's obviously very concerning that's happening. And we're tracking that in real time.
One might assume that it's Israel that's responsible for these shutdowns. And if that were the case, they'd probably say, well, it's a security issue because we need to stop the Hamas terrorists communicating with each other. So I suppose the two-part question, really, can we assume it's Israel? And if so, how do we know?
Right. So this has been the big question that we've also been trying to answer, monitoring all of this. And we know that Gaza is highly reliant on Israel for its infrastructure. So much as it gets its electricity from Israel and it gets other critical services from Israel, it also does rely on Israeli infrastructure for internet service. So in terms of means and capability, Israel certainly has that capability to switch off internet access and telephony in Gaza. But having said that, Israel has also been quite a vocal voice in terms of speaking out against internet shutdowns and against cutting off populations. Israel's obviously very critical of Iran when Iran implements this kind of internet shutdown on its own population. So there has been something of an impetus for Israel not to switch off the internet in Gaza. Having said that, at the moment, what we're seeing is that there are a variety of reasons why the internet is being disrupted. Right, so we have the airstrikes, we have kinetic damage to telecom towers, to internet exchange points. But beyond that, we also see that there are these unexplained, or at least not through traditional warfare, that these disruptions are happening through technical means, potentially, from the upstream. And we've tracked this three times now, mostly towards the end of October, really picking up recently. And these are experiences, total or near total internet blackouts, telecommunication blackouts. There are some signs that this is being implemented externally from Israel. So there is a sense that that is happening, which is obviously concerning when it comes to keeping civilians and uninvolved people connected and able to communicate.
But would there be some mileage in saying, well, this is a security issue, you know, that we need to stop the Hamas fighters communicating with each other, and that's for the good of everybody in Gaza, not just Israel? Is there any mileage in that, or indeed in your long experience of looking at and monitoring internet shutdowns? Is this the kind of argument that's often given by authorities that do impose internet shutdowns?
Well, that's a great question, and I think that it varies case by case. You have to look at the intent, you also have to look at the affected population, and you also have to consider the right of countries to defend themselves in the face of attacks, in particularly against civilian populations. So you take all of that and you weigh it up, and I think, you know, the internet is a reflection of our society, and when the internet is on lockdown, so are our basic freedoms. We can't access fundamental rights if we don't have connectivity. We can't access those rights that are given to everyone, even those who might be combatants. So, yes, from a military or militaristic point of view, hybrid warfare is real. One of the goals is certainly to knock out the telecommunication lines that the other side has. But this is also a unique kind of theater of warfare if you look at the situation, because one side is so dependent on the other, while there are also combatants within, you know, embedded in that side. So you add that all up together. And I think, you know, I understand where some Israeli voices are coming from when they say we can't even consider the possibility of connecting Hamas and allowing them to spread whatever, maybe disinformation or what they're spreading. But you also have to consider that there are civilians there who are really in a difficult situation, who haven't necessarily supported these kinds of attacks against Israel. And, you know, they're just trying to lead ordinary lives or just get out of there. And they need that internet connectivity. I think, as far as we can tell, Israel is disrupting in some of these cases, the upstream connectivity. And I think that is problematic because it also goes against what Israel has been saying for so long, that internet services must be maintained by government.
Yeah, and of course there will be those sympathetic to Hamas saying that shutting off their internet, even if it is to quell their activities, or especially if it is to quell their activities, just isn't on. It's a step too far. Some people might say that. Now, Anya is here. We met her at the top of the programme. She's the producer of this podcast. And Anya, we've worked with each other for many years, previously on a BBC World Service programme called Digital Planet. And on that show, we looked at internet shutdowns a lot, didn't we? So as a producer who puts the running order together and is keen on doing these items, what is it about this subject that you think we need to discuss and to, I suppose, kind of convey to our listeners?
Well, I think the most important thing is that you're hearing this, yeah? You've gone, you've downloaded, you've subscribed, you've got it on your phone, on your desktop, you're listening to it. And there are people who can't do that. Now, that might be just a temporary thing because there's been an election and the government has decided, well, that's it. We're shutting things down, or at least we're lowering the services, yeah, to say 2G. So it's more difficult for people to communicate, and it's also easier for the government to know what potentially protesters might be sharing between each other. So that's one issue. And I think that is incredibly important.
Yeah, and the very fact that people are listening to this shows they have some connectivity, and that is not to be taken for granted, as Alp said there. You know, it's as fundamental as what running water or electricity.
And there are short-term blockages, yeah, aren't there? But there are also long-term. I mean, I remember reporting, and we covered this so many times, on the much longer, you know, we're talking over a year, some of them.
Oh, sure. And I'm thinking about Myanmar, and you can help us out here, Alp, because, I mean, Myanmar's been shut off on and off, isn't it, for about 4 years or something, and more kind of off than on?
Myanmar has had serious extended internet shutdowns for a variety of reasons, but always connected to the political turmoil, obviously the military takeover that has happened there. And I think that internet in Myanmar, I think also the other country that stands out would be Sudan. And there are some parallels between the two in terms of how military and authoritarian rule are directly linked to these types of destructions. But I think that in these cases, you're seeing that internet access gives the people a voice, and that's threatening to the regimes that seek to control those populations. So in these cases, you're seeing that the restriction of internet connectivity is a direct means of controlling the population, to the extent that it's normalized. And then we can see also that atrocities have taken place when specifically authorities are switching off the internet in advance, premeditated disruptions, simply to hide what's happening. So we've seen that full range of kind of both regional disruptions and also nation-scale disruptions happening in Myanmar and also in Sudan. I think these are two of the most severe cases where we have extended disruptions. But on the other side of the spectrum, we also have Iran, for example, which is a very digitally connected country, but that is willing to switch off its people at will. This happened during the Musa Amini protests, obviously very deadly clashes between security forces and general public. But we also see some of the ongoing results of that. Every Friday, for example, Iran has been switching off a region called Zahedan. And this is now like clockwork. Every Friday we will track that disruption that happens in that region just because people are protesting after Friday prayers. So you go from this whole kind of scenario of nation-scale disruptions all the way down to highly targeted just-in-time disruptions for a specific region.
Yeah, Anya.
And that's very obvious in India with the national exams. That keeps happening time and time again, that there are internet shutdowns around this time because there are questions of people perhaps sharing exam papers. And you can see that, you know, if you were the Minister of Education, well, what would you do? The easiest way of stopping anything like that, any form of cheating on a large scale, would be to do that. But obviously then that has much wider impacts on the economy. We've heard so many times from people who say, well, my business failed because I was without internet for 3-4 days. I use WhatsApp for payments, very common in Latin America, for instance, and they just can't get the money. What about students studying? Again, they cannot access this. And you mentioned Sudan, Alp. I remember covering a story about a new payment system for refugee camps. And if there's no internet, people can't use that to pay. And so you get a great technological advancement that seems to be helping these people who are in dire need. And then it suddenly stops because there's no connectivity.
Yeah, people who are the unbanked, for instance, who might be, as you were saying there, Anya, using WhatsApp to run their businesses. And this seems to me, Alp, to be a particularly pernicious form of control. You know, I remember on Digital Planet, we talked about Indian control of Muslim minorities in India, or, you know, at least controlling or throttling or indeed shutting down their internet, and to some of the terrible economic consequences that Anya just mentioned.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
AI is changing the game of business. Will you be on the winning team? I'm Jordan Wilson, the host of the Everyday AI podcast and your coach to help you learn the X's and O's of AI. Artificial intelligence isn't just a new player in the game, it's a new sport altogether. So if you don't quickly put AI into play, your competitors will run up the score. I've spent my whole life building winning teams, from coaching basketball to working with big players like Nike and Jordan Brand. My next move? Helping you win with Everyday AI. Listen wherever you get your podcasts or on everydayaipodcast.com. Let's tap into AI together and put points on the board.
Yeah, I mean, it's this phenomenon of exam internet shutdowns that, you know, you mentioned, Anya. And I think this was one that always blows my mind, because you have these countries that have fairly reasonable infrastructure. Okay, they're connected, their populations rely on that internet access. And then you get the Ministry of Education saying, look, we're going to be switching off the internet every day for this many hours. I think for Iraq, we calculated just a couple of years ago that it was causing a minimum of $40 million USD damage to the economy for each disruption. And that's also a daily occurrence, so that's repeated. And these are really economies that are trying to develop and trying to establish themselves. And these countries are shooting themselves in the collective feet. This year, we tracked a series of internet shutdowns, completely, in my view, pointless, in Iraq and in Syria also, that took place over days and days and days. And each day, you just see that these economies, these people, these livelihoods are just being kicked while they're down. It's distressing to see. And it's not always as innocent as it might seem. Although it does appear to be a measure to prevent cheating in exams, quite often this is connected with government corruption. So in fact, what's going on is that you have officials who have access to the exam papers and to the answers as well, who are simply selling the answers. So as much as they're trying to prevent the kids from cheating in these exams, they're also actually just trying to rein in this corruption that exists and is endemic within their government. So there is a kind of sordid side to it, even though it seems perhaps more innocent than some of the political shutdowns that we've seen.
Well, I mean, that's just crazy. And also, I'd love to talk to you a bit more about how you detect these shutdowns and what your observatory looks like. Maybe a bit about the future of detecting internet shutdowns. I bet AI's got something to do with it. I'm just throwing that out there, Al. But I said, why don't we have a little break from this subject? Because as promised, I'd like to go to our listeners, if we might. It's as if they're in the room with us, isn't it? What have we got here? This is a very nice one from DK Mock, who says, hello, love the mission statement and tagline. Really enjoyed episode 3 of Somewhere on Earth. Great topics, interesting guests, and it was lovely to meet Peter. So that was Peter Guest, who was our expert on that episode. DK continues, loved hearing about how Wikipedia entries can impact awards and professional recognition for women scientists. DK says, very interested in the progress of 3D printed housing and was wondering about the fire safety status of homes made from recycled plastics. If these homes were to catch fire, would the smoke be any more toxic than it'd be with conventional materials? Can these homes be made more fire resistant? That's a brilliant question, isn't it,
DK?
It
is. So
why didn't I think of asking that? That's the thing. The listeners, you just get the listeners to do this show. Brilliant. Anyway, sorry. So you've been following up.
I have. I actually emailed Ross McGuire, the CEO of Azure Printed Homes, who was on episode 3 recently, and he says, it's worth noting that plastics are already very heavily prevalent in existing structures, in many waterproofing applications such as membranes, flashings, flat roofs, windows, doors, etc. Neither are healthy of the environment, but the toxins released from burning plastic are worse than burning, say, wood. Azure combat this by applying a fire coating to the exterior of the unit prior to our UV coating. So there is some coating going on there. And then he adds, we also use more traditional flame retardant finishes in our interior installations so that it mimics more a traditional home from the inside.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so there is some fire protection with that coating.
There is.
Yeah, there all is. Right. DK, a brilliant question. Should have thought of that. Sorry. But thanks for thinking of it for me. The listeners think of the good questions, so I don't have to. Danny Lloyd is a listener who's followed us since the days when we were called Click and then to Digital Planet and also the Gareth and Bill cast, which is another podcast that I do, and then to Somewhere on Earth. So I think Danny, it's fair to say, is a frequent flyer, as I like to call our most loyal listeners. Danny has two pieces of feedback. He says, first, could you please fix the chapter names in the podcast to be a bit more descriptive, maybe with the name of the guest or the topic? At the moment, they just come up as item 1, item 2, etc. So Danny wants more metadata.
Well, funny you should say that, but our lovely production manager, Liz, who's on the other side of the glass, and myself were learning how to do that today in our platform podcasting software. So hopefully they should all be there by now. If they're not, please get in touch, because everything should automatically feed through. It can take a little while, you know, might not be there just now, but hopefully very soon.
Oh, that's a bit fancy.
It is. Yeah, good. We're clever,
good on us. Yeah, amazing. You'd almost think we're a technology podcast. Danny also says, could you make a Mastodon feed so I can follow you all in the Fediverse?
Well, we've had Mastodon. There was also a Blue Sky request from someone as well.
Yes.
There was, wasn't there?
I think a couple of those.
You've got a couple of those. We have. We are getting there. At the moment, you can find us on Facebook, Somewhere on Earth, the Global Tech Podcast. Please join the group. It is a new group. There's already quite a lot of discussion on there, and it's lovely to chat to people there. We are on Twitter /X. We are feeding through to other social media as we speak. So we will get there.
We will get there.
That's the plan anyway. We are on it.
We're still putting this thing together. You know, we're, you know, just kind of, yeah, there's a big to-do list of things that we still want to do and, you know, get it as good as it can be. And so that includes going into the Fediverse, and we will see you there, Danny. Sam Quinn says, I'd listen to anything that Gareth presents. Looking forward to more.
Oh, goodness me. How big is your head going to be, Gareth?
Well, I'll move swiftly on in that case. And also, Stefano Gazzali, he heard our second episode and says, awesome episode all. And we'll have this one from Jennifer. Really important email, this one from Jennifer Ray Crato. Drove to work listening to this podcast, says Jennifer. Great job, folks. You're off to a very strong start. Jennifer goes on to comment on Ghislaine's description of a breast examination. And so Jennifer says, most mammogram technicians try their best to not make the experience any worse than it has to be. But I've also had some really bad experiences, says Jennifer. I've said for years that this approach just doesn't make sense. I'm so glad that people are working on an alternative. I remember the discussion on the Digital Planet Listeners Facebook group about how people would react to a robot's touch. And I don't remember what I thought at the time, but when it comes to mammograms, I'm definitely on Team Robot, says Jennifer.
Indeed. And I think that's the response we've been getting. You know, talking to people, many women have just said Ghislaine's description was so accurate and just exactly how it is. It is quite a terrifying experience, I've been told. I haven't had one yet, but that is going to come in part of my life quite soon, I'm sure. And alternatives need to be found because, you know, in the UK, for instance, women have them every few years. If you go to other countries in Europe, women have them every year. And it takes quite a bit of time and effort and staff, et cetera, to go and have this done. So if you could nip into a supermarket, or if there was one of these robot machine screening systems at your local health surgery or health clinic, it would make things so much easier.
Heck of a difference. And Alp, you're very interested, aren't you, in the technology here? And just to remind the listeners, this robot that kind of had, for want of a better description, these fingers, these kind of long metallic fingers, which sounds kind of gross and really horrible, but these fingers that into which the breast would be inserted, but they had these inflatable sacs and some very clever technology. I was particularly struck by this. I remember in the interview, these inflatable sacs, so that when one of the fingers touched against some breast tissue, a camera within the inflatable sac could infer the amount of pressure. It's just so clever. And you're quite interested in that aspect of the technology, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, I've dabbled in robotics. I studied artificial intelligence in Edinburgh many years ago. And I think that, you know, the grippers, the end effectors, as they're called, on these robots, has been one of the areas that hasn't seen much development. You know, the hands have been seen as the actuators, so they're kind of outputs and not inputs. But by getting that feedback loop going and actually getting the palms to inform the hand and then the robot mind of what's going on is obviously a very smart way of getting these actuators to do what you want and to do it carefully. And there's also recently, you know, with Elon Musk's new robotics platform, one of the advances there is the dexterity that you can see in the hands and this ability to pick up objects and kind of correct things, almost like a tailor's hand or an expert's hands. And now you see that robots are very rapidly reaching that area of dexterity where maybe an expert violinist or a surgeon might have been needed before. So what might have seemed absurd a few years ago now actually just makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it's an exciting area, isn't it? So dear people, this is how you can get in touch. And I know it's a bit tedious listening to a bloke reading out email addresses and stuff, but let's just do this, okay? So our email address is hello@somewhereonearth.co, hello@somewhereonearth.co. And on WhatsApp, we are code 44 7486 329 484. So just jog back on your podcatcher if you didn't get that the first time. But we'd love to hear from you. And it's just kind of an inside secret as to what goes on behind the scenes here. We're still trying to build an audience. So to be honest, if you email us or get in touch, there's quite a good chance, well, we'll certainly read it, and there's a good chance that it'll get onto the podcast. So just remember that, that this time next year will be the next smash hit huge podcast.
Absolutely.
And you'll be lucky to get a mention. So make the most of it. And it's always nice. None of us ever grow out of it just hearing somebody mention our name on the radio or a podcast, I think. There we go. I've sold it all right, haven't I?
I think Anya? You have. I think we're all right there.
And Anya, producer Anya, you would agree that we do want to build whole items around listener content. So we're saying it like we mean it. We love our listeners and we want more of them. We care about what they have to say.
If you want to know about something or have heard about a technology, think, oh, that's cool, but I want to know more about it, drop us a line.
We'll look into it.
Please leave a message on the WhatsApp. It's really easy. You press that microphone symbol. Yeah. And you just leave the message, and we can even play that.
As a voice memo. So I wonder who will be the first ever person to get a voice memo into Somewhere on Earth.
Oh, I can't wait.
Oh, there you go, folks.
Please, 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 please. The phone is on now. I carry it with me all the time, waiting for it to go beep.
Please give us a voice memo. Somebody love us. So yeah, do that. And it'd be so cool if we can get some, actually hear the listeners in
and
the podcast.
Stories that we haven't come across, you know. Do, by all means, comment on what we're doing, but please actually contact us, because we are Somewhere on Earth. We find the story, we make it news, we hope to change the world by telling people about it. But there are stories we can't find because they are either remote or they're just not talked about. Yeah. Or you've come across them. So tell us so we can tell our listeners.
Yes, please. Okay, so I think we've bossed you around enough, dear listener. So just before we leave it, let's come back to you, Alp, and finish on internet shutdowns, because I am interested in how you detect them. Because I just thought, by their very nature, an internet shutdown is like an absence of connectivity. And therefore, you know, if you're detecting the absence of anything, that's quite tricky. How do you do it?
Gareth, you've hit the nail on the head, because what we're looking at isn't the availability of something. It's all about what is going missing. And this makes the analysis a little more difficult. It also means that you need different approaches to monitoring, especially at global scale, than you would be, say, tracking traffic or some kind of metric on a website, because there is no ideal 100%. There is no ideal 0%. Everything is relative to what it was a day ago, a week ago. And you have this multidimensional kind of data that you're working with. So you can slice and dice it into a geolocation, a region, a presumed location. And you can also slice it into a network, an autonomous network, as it's called in network engineering. And it's really about finding combinations of these, comparing with previous levels, and then connecting that with the human story. You know, what's actually happening? How relevant is this to the situation on the ground? And are people being impacted by this? So it kind of combines all that big data analytics with then a bit of data-driven journalism. And also, you know, alerting, just catching these incidents in real time. And that means that you need some automation. It means that you need some AI to kind of separate incidents that look serious from those that aren't. And you pull that all together, and then suddenly you start to get a picture of what's going on around the world, all around the world in real time.
All right. And really immature question here then, because you're an observatory, and I've just got this image of some kind of Capcom style center with loads of screens and, you know, just kind of dimly lit, you know, so that your amazing face is kind of lit up in the incandescent glow of the screens as you survey the world. Or is it more like a spreadsheet that comes up on your computer? What's the reality?
There have been a lot of blinking lights in the office, and I do sometimes switch to red during a crisis situation. Whoa. just to get the lighting right, because you're focusing on so much telemetry, so many real incidents, that you need, I think, you need to zone in and kind of tune into what's happening. Also, in terms of the technology, you're processing, storing a lot of data. I mean, this is global internet connectivity. And then, you know, we try not to rely on the cloud because of the sensitivity of some of this data. And that means that you have racks and racks of stuff that you're obviously using to track and analyze this. So it is a bit cyberpunk, but I think also it's also at the end of the day, it is a newsroom, and it's about kind of connecting those two different types of coverage into a meaningful story.
Yeah, and you mentioned data then, and these rich data sets that are just growing every day. You're getting more and more data and insights, potentially. So I can't help thinking just about the future of the kind of work that you do, and thinking, well, if you have all the data, then you must be bringing in algorithms to, for one thing, just, I don't know, chart trends through that data, but also maybe to look at all that telemetry data, this huge mass of real-time data, so that an alarm is triggered in a more relevant way. And is that an algorithmic thing, or is it still pretty manual, for want of a better term?
It's definitely a combination of both that human analysis and the automation. I think the automation is getting stronger now, but a lot of this isn't off-the-shelf technology. It's a very unique type of data analytics. It's not even what big Fortune 500 companies face. And so much of the challenge is about getting it to fit on the types of devices that you have, as opposed to, say, an intelligence agency or something that has vast resources. And a lot of, actually, in setting this up, a lot of my work was in working on the compression algorithms, column-based storage, and really shrinking what might be hundreds of gigabytes, terabytes of data into a very small space, which allows you to then analyze it more efficiently and get the answer that you need, so that you can then figure out what's happening on, whether it's in a bit of the Gaza Strip or whether it's in Sudan or Myanmar. And I think that it's just the combination of code and journalism and real-time analytics. It's a fusion of those.
All right. And any final comment from you, Anya? Or mainly just Gareth wrap it up?
I think just one thing, because I do remember being in China many years ago reporting for the BBC, and you couldn't get onto anything at all. And to file anything for the newsroom was incredibly, incredibly difficult. And there were days when you ended up doing it on the phone, and you should have been able, you know, maybe not quite yet drop a file, but certainly contact our control room and be able to file. And we just couldn't. We just couldn't connect. So so it definitely impacts. And you also, I always felt very lost during that time. And I can imagine that if this is going on for quite a while, that losing that ability to just be able to check something out, to just make sure I'm right on this, must be very, very scary. Yeah. For some people.
Exactly. So getting a very brief experience as a visitor or as a visiting journalist into a country. And yeah, you know, for some people, this is their daily reality, and pretty miserable it is too.
Yeah. People, when they visit China, I think they're visiting a modern country, very interconnected. But then there's also this disconnect with expectations, and you've got the censored internet. Interestingly, China isn't one of the countries that features very high in terms of internet shutdowns, because there's already such a tight grip on connectivity. There just isn't that need to actually deploy internet shutdowns by authorities, because they've already controlled at a higher level what is flowing across the wire.
So China gets the best of both worlds in a way, if you're the regime, which is controlling what is said and what is communicated, while at the same time not balking your economy through shutdowns. All right. Well, we will leave it there. Alp Toker, thank you very much. And this is where we do the credits. I quite like the credits at the end. Sound editor today, our sound editor is Keziah Wenham-Kenyon. Audio is by Dylan Burton. Thanks to everybody here at lovely Lanson's team, Farner. Our production manager is Liz Tui. And of course, our editor and the producer sitting in today in the studio is Anya Litarovich. And we'll have more Somewhere on Earth for you, with your comments, please, dear listener, next time. See you then. Bye.